A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been walking through an IKEA showroom, looking at the beds and desks, and wondering where the actual line is. Can you climb into a bed and take a test nap? Can you set up your laptop and work from a display desk for a few hours? The IKEA enthusiast community is huge and deeply weird, and he wants to know if anyone has actually pushed these boundaries and reported back, which of course they have.
Of course they have. And the answer is more complicated than yes or no, because IKEA has basically built a $20 billion global experiment in how far you can blur the line between a store and someone's living room before the lawyers get involved.
Before we get to the nappers and the remote workers, we need to understand the stage they're performing on. The IKEA showroom isn't an accident. It's one of the most meticulously engineered retail environments ever designed.
The showroom is built around what they call the flow path, a single winding route that takes you through every department in a specific order. Living rooms, then dining, then kitchens, then bedrooms. You can't shortcut it. There are no straight lines to the checkout. And the whole thing is designed to feel like a home you might actually live in, not a warehouse with price tags.
If you've ever tried to deviate from that path, if you've spotted the marketplace up ahead and thought, I'll just duck through this living room display to get there faster, you know it doesn't work. The layout funnels you. The shortcuts dead-end at fake walls. The arrows on the floor are gentle but insistent. It's like a river that's been engineered to flow at exactly the speed that makes you browse.
That's not accidental either. The flow path was studied. IKEA consulted with retail psychologists in the 1980s when they were expanding beyond Sweden, and one of the key findings was that when customers feel slightly disoriented, their resistance to impulse purchases drops. Not lost, mind you, just disoriented enough that the normal mental checklist of I came here for a bookshelf gets fuzzy around the edges.
Which is why the showroom apartments are fully dressed. The fake books, the fake televisions, the fake fruit in the bowl. They're not just decoration. They're stage dressing for a fantasy of domestic life that you're supposed to slip into.
Critically, there are no salespeople hovering. No commission breath on your neck. That's deliberate. Traditional furniture stores have this adversarial energy. Someone follows you around, asks about your budget, tries to upsell the extended warranty on a coffee table. IKEA removed all of that. The showroom is a soft sell. You're supposed to relax, linger, imagine yourself in the space.
Which is exactly where the paradox kicks in. IKEA's business model depends on high foot traffic and long dwell times. The longer you stay, the more likely you are to buy. The restaurant exists for this reason. The meatballs aren't a side hustle. They're a retention strategy. Keep you in the building for 3 hours instead of one, and your average basket size goes up something like 30%.
Every minute someone naps in a mom bed is a minute they're not buying a mom bed. And that's the tension. IKEA wants you to feel at home, but you are not at home. The question is where the tolerance ends.
Here's where it gets interesting, because the tolerance isn't just about corporate policy. It's about architecture. Think about what a showroom bed actually is. It's a fully made bed with sheets and a duvet and pillows, in a room that looks like a bedroom, with lighting that's been calibrated to feel warm and residential. They've built a stage set that says sleep here, with every design choice, and then they're surprised when people take the suggestion.
It's the retail equivalent of offering someone a chair and then being confused when they sit down. The bed is made. The pillows are fluffed. There's a bedside table with a fake lamp and a fake book. The entire environment is a nonverbal invitation. And IKEA knows this. They're not naive. They designed the invitation.
The question isn't really, why do people nap in IKEA? The question is, at what point does IKEA decide the invitation has been accepted too enthusiastically?
The tolerance is deliberately ambiguous. IKEA doesn't publish a formal policy that says you can sleep in the beds for exactly 17 minutes before security escorts you out. The ambiguity is the policy. It gives store managers enormous discretion, and it lets IKEA avoid ever having to say in writing that napping is permitted. Because if they did, the liability lawyers would have a field day.
There's also a cultural layer here. IKEA is Swedish, and Swedish culture has this concept of lagom. Not too little, not too much. The idea that reasonable people know where the boundaries are without having them spelled out. The problem is that reasonable people have very different ideas about what counts as testing a mattress versus what counts as moving in.
What happens when you actually try to live in the showroom? Let's look at the people who have done exactly that.
The boundary pushers fall into a few categories. You've got the nappers, the remote workers, and then the full-on overnight challenge people. The nappers are the most common. The Ikea IKEA a nap challenge on TikTok had 47 million views as of April this year. That's not a trend, that's a movement.
The nap spectrum matters. There's a real difference between the power nap, 15 to 20 minutes, shoe still on, maybe you're genuinely testing a mattress or considering, and the deep sleeper. The deep sleeper is the person who takes off their shoes, gets under the duvet, and is fully unconscious for 45 minutes plus.
There was an IKEA employee AMA on the Tales from Retail subreddit, where a worker described waking a customer who had drooled on a JARVFJLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLLL evaluating a product. You're a biohazard incident.
The drool is the line.
The drool is absolutely the line. But the more interesting question is, what happens before the drool? And we actually know the answer, because IKEA's internal training manual leaked on Reddit in 2024. It lays out what they call the three-step approach for handling customers who are, let's say, overstaying their welcome on a showroom bed.
Step one is friendly acknowledgement. A staff member walks by and says something like, getting comfortable, or that's a popular model. No accusation, just presence. The goal is to let the customer know they've been seen.
This is such a delicate piece of social engineering. They're not saying you're doing something wrong. They're not even implying it. They're just making their presence known, which triggers a very specific psychological response. Most people, when they know they've been observed, will self-correct their behavior without being asked. It's the same reason security mirrors reduce shoplifting more effectively than security guards shouting at people.
Step two is offering assistance. Can I help you find the right size, or would you like me to check inventory on that one? Still friendly, still in customer service mode, but now there's a subtle shift. You're being treated as someone who might need help making a decision, which implies you should be making a decision.
Step three is the direct question about purchase intent. Are you interested in buying this mattress today, or would you like me to get a cart? The genius of this approach is that IKEA never says you can't do what you're doing. They just make the interaction awkward enough that you self-regulate. The goal is to make you feel like you're the one who decided to get up.
It's the retail equivalent of a parent counting to three. They never actually tell you what happens at three, but you know you don't want to find out.
This is where the misconception comes in. Most people assume IKEA staff are trained to immediately kick out anyone who lies down. That's not true. The training emphasizes a soft, escalating approach. They'd much rather have a sleeping customer than a viral video of a security guard dragging someone out of a Hemnes daybed.
Think about the PR calculus there. A video of someone being woken up gently by a staff member who offers them a cup of coffee? That's charming. That's brand positive. A video of a security guard physically removing a sleeping teenager? That's a headline. That's a week of bad press. IKEA's entire approach is built around avoiding the second scenario at almost any cost.
Which brings us to the remote workers. This is a whole separate category. In 2025, Vice ran a piece profiling three people who regularly use IKEA showrooms as co-working spaces. Free Wi-Fi, consistent temperature, and what one of them described as the ambient noise of families arguing over furniture.
I love that phrase. It's like a lo-fi study beats playlist, but with more existential despair about shelving units.
The most documented case was a Reddit thread from March 2025. A user detailed working a full 8-hour remote shift at a Colorbird desk in the Brooklyn IKEA. They brought a laptop, a portable charger, noise-canceling headphones, and a water bottle. They took meetings. They ate lunch in the restaurant. And at one point, a staff member approached them and asked if they needed help finding the checkout.
Not, are you working here? Not, you need to leave. Do you need help finding the checkout? That's step two of the three-step approach in action. The staff member knew exactly what was happening, but the script doesn't allow for, excuse me, are you using our showroom as a WeWork?
The Reddit user said they responded with, no thanks, just testing the desk height. And the staff member walked away. They finished their shift.
Which raises the question, why does IKEA tolerate this at all? What's the actual financial cost?
The cost is real but complicated. IKEA's 2025 sustainability report showed a 12% increase in what they call product interaction incidents in showrooms year over year. That's the corporate euphemism for people sleeping in beds, spilling coffee on desks, and generally wearing out the display models.
The wear is not trivial. In January this year, IKEA settled a lawsuit with a customer who injured their back on a showroom Strandman recliner that had been worn out by excessive testing. The recliner's mechanism failed because it had been sat in, reclined, and generally abused by thousands of people who had no intention of buying it. The settlement terms were confidential, but the case forced IKEA to implement a wear and tear rotation schedule for high-use showroom items.
Think about what high use means in this context. A Strandman recliner in a normal home gets used maybe a few hours a day by one or two people. A Strandman recliner in a busy IKEA showroom gets used by dozens of people daily, many of them sitting down hard, reclining aggressively, treating it like an amusement park ride. The wear curve is completely different from anything the original design anticipated.
There's real liability here. If someone naps in a bed and the slats break, IKEA is on the hook, and the legal framework varies dramatically by country. In Germany, store security can legally detain a customer for suspected misuse of premises under Section 123 of the Criminal Code. That's trespassing. In the US, it's much trickier. IKEA has been sued twice since 2022 for negligent security after customers were injured while sleeping in showrooms.
The US cases are fascinating from a legal standpoint because they turn on a question that hasn't been fully settled. Does a store have a duty of care to someone who's using their display furniture in a way it wasn't intended to be used? If you climb into a showroom bed and the frame collapses, is that your fault for sleeping in it? Or IKEA's fault for building a display that couldn't handle the very thing it was designed to look like it could handle?
The courts haven't given a clear answer, which is exactly why IKEA prefers the soft approach. Every time they formally eject someone, they create a record. Every time they post a sign that says, "Do not sleep in beds," they're acknowledging that sleeping in beds is a foreseeable risk, which strengthens future liability claims. The ambiguity isn't just cultural, it's legal strategy.
Yet they keep letting it happen. Because the calculation is that the goodwill and the viral marketing and the sheer weird loyalty of the IKEA enthusiast community are worth more than the cost of replacing a few worn-out Strandman recliners.
Speaking of the enthusiast community, the IKEA hacker forums are a goldmine. There was a post on IKEAHackers.net in 2025 that detailed how to identify showroom-only versions of the same product versus the warehouse version by checking the product code suffix. The showroom models are sometimes subtly different from what you actually take home.
This is where IKEA has been quietly adapting. They're not just sitting back and letting this happen. They've been watching, and they've been redesigning.
The 2024 MALM bed frame now has a slightly harder slatted base in showroom models compared to the actual product. This was confirmed by comparing the 2025 product catalog specifications. The showroom version uses a different slat spacing, subtle enough that you wouldn't notice unless you were specifically looking for it, but enough to make an 8-hour nap noticeably less comfortable.
The KU Leppergate desk in showrooms is now bolted to the floor at a slight angle. Not enough to be obvious, but enough to feel slightly off if you're trying to type for 3 hours. It's hostile architecture, IKEA style. Not spikes on a bench, but a 1-degree tilt that makes your wrists ache just enough that you decide to go home.
This is the part that I find brilliant. They're not saying, go home. They're not putting up signs. They're not stationing guards. They're just making the environment slightly less hospitable in ways that are almost impossible to articulate. You can't quite put your finger on why the desk feels wrong. You just know that after an hour, you don't want to be there anymore.
That's the Scandinavian passive aggression I deeply respect. They won't tell you to leave, but they will make the desk subtly uncomfortable in a way you can't quite articulate.
The cultural variation is fascinating. Japanese IKEA stores have the strictest enforcement in the world. Staff are trained to intervene within 30 seconds of a customer lying down. You haven't even adjusted the pillow yet.
Meanwhile, in Sweden, a Stockholm store manager was quoted in Dagens Nyheter last year saying, "If you need a nap, you need a nap." That's the most Swedish sentence ever uttered. It's practically a national motto.
The permissiveness in Sweden isn't just cultural laxity, it's actually strategic. The Swedish stores are the brand's home turf. Any viral video of a Swedish IKEA kicking out a napper would be a PR disaster. Better to let a few people sleep and frame it as charming Scandinavian hospitality.
The Chinese stores are another interesting case. IKEA in China has actually had to deal with a phenomenon where elderly people treat the showroom as a social club. They come in groups, sit on the sofas for hours, chat, sometimes bring snacks. It's not napping, it's community building. And IKEA's response has been fascinating. They've experimented with designated social areas and even organized events for seniors, essentially formalizing the behavior they can't stop.
This is the pattern. When the behavior reaches a certain threshold, IKEA doesn't fight it. They absorb it. They build infrastructure around it. They put up a sign that says social area, and suddenly the thing that was a problem becomes a feature.
Which brings us to the co-optation strategy. IKEA's 2025 partnership with the remote work platform Remote.com created pop-up co-working events in showrooms. They explicitly invited people to come work there for two-hour blocks with free coffee. That's not tolerance, that's an embrace. They're taking the remote worker phenomenon and turning it into a marketing event.
The 2026 pilot program in three U.S. stores, Paramus, New Jersey, Burbank, California, and Schaumburg, Illinois, introduces formal testing zones with designated areas for trying products, including a nap pod with a 20-minute timer.
The nap pod is the most explicit acknowledgement yet that people were already napping. It's IKEA saying, "We see you, we know what you're doing, and rather than fight it, we're going to build you a little room with a timer and make it feel like an amenity instead of a liability."
Let's talk about that 20-minute timer because it's not arbitrary. 20 minutes is the widely accepted duration of a power nap, enough to get restorative rest without entering deep sleep and waking up groggy. IKEA didn't just pick a number. They did the research. They're offering you a scientifically optimized nap in a controlled environment, which is simultaneously generous and completely controlling.
The question is whether formalizing it kills the magic. Part of the appeal of the IKEA nap is that it feels slightly transgressive. You're getting away with something. You're reclaiming a commercial space for genuine human rest. If it's sanctioned, if there's a timer and a queue and a staff member handing you a pillowcase, does it still feel like a small act of rebellion?
But IKEA doesn't need it to feel like rebellion. They need it to not feel like a lawsuit.
Where does that leave you, the listener, who just wants to know if that Caliburd desk is actually comfortable for an 8-hour workday?
Here's what we know from the people who've done the research. If you want to seriously test an IKEA product, go on a weekday morning, Tuesday or Wednesday, between 9 and 11 a.m. The stores are emptiest then, and staff are least likely to intervene. Avoid weekends entirely, and avoid the hour before closing, which is when security does their final walkthroughs and is most likely to notice someone who's been in the same spot for 3 hours.
The three-step approach is a script, and scripts can be navigated. If a staff member asks if you need help, respond with a specific product question. Does this mattress come in a firmer variant? Or what's the weight limit on this desk? That resets the interaction from loiterer to serious customer. You're no longer the person sleeping in the display bed. You're the person doing research before a purchase.
If you're a remote worker who wants to use IKEA as a workspace, the restaurant is actually the better option. Same Wi-Fi, better seating, no showroom pressure, and the Swedish meatballs are a legitimate lunch. Nobody's going to ask you about your purchase intent while you're eating a plate of Kurtbullar.
The restaurant is the one zone where lingering is not just tolerated, but expected. IKEA designed the restaurant to keep you in the building. Using it as a co-working space is arguably more aligned with their business model than buying a single LACK table and leaving.
For the serious boundary pushers, the people who want to document and share, the IKEA enthusiast community is the place to do it. The IKEA hacker forums, the relevant subreddits, the niche discords, that's where the collective knowledge base lives. That's how we know about the showroom-only product codes and the slightly tilted desks.
The community has effectively crowdsourced the unwritten rules. They've mapped the tolerance threshold store by store, country by country. The Brooklyn IKEA is more permissive than the one in Queens. The Burbank store, pre-pilot program, was known among enthusiasts as one of the most nap-friendly locations in the U.S. The Schomburg store has historically been stricter, which is probably why it was chosen for the testing zone pilot.
What's remarkable is that this knowledge base exists at all. IKEA has spent decades building a global retail empire, and a parallel community has spent years reverse engineering its tolerance algorithms. It's like a distributed anthropological study of corporate hospitality.
IKEA knows this. They're almost certainly reading the forums. The three-step approach didn't materialize out of nowhere. It was developed in response to observed behavior. The tilted desks and harder slats are design responses to documented misuse. IKEA and the boundary pushers are in a slow-motion arms race, and both sides are learning from each other.
As IKEA gets smarter about monitoring, the question becomes, will there still be room for the nap?
Because here's what's coming. At the 2026 Consumer Electronics Show, IKEA announced plans for AI-powered showroom monitoring. Computer vision systems that detect prolonged stationary behavior and alert staff. The rollout is planned for 2027.
This changes the dynamic completely. Right now, the boundary between testing and loitering is enforced by human beings who have discretion, who can choose to look the other way, who might themselves think the whole thing is kind of funny. An AI doesn't have discretion. An AI doesn't think drool on a JRVFJLLLET is funny. An AI just sees a stationary heat signature that's exceeded the dwell time threshold and pings the nearest staff member's device.
The ambiguity that made the system work, the human judgment, the cultural variation, the store manager who says, if you need a nap, you need a nap. All of that gets flattened into a binary, stationary or moving, compliant or flagged. The nap becomes a data point.
That's the deeper tension here. The IKEA showroom is a mirror of our relationship with commercial space more broadly. We want to feel at home, but we're always being watched. The nap is a small act of rebellion against the idea that every square foot of space must be optimized for transaction.
The showroom is designed to feel like a home, but it's not a home. It's a stage set. The books on the shelves are fake. The family photos are stock images. The coffee in the mugs is plastic. And yet people keep trying to live in it because the simulation is good enough that it triggers something real.
There's a quote from the Vice piece that stuck with me. One of the remote workers said, "It's the most productive I've ever been. Something about being surrounded by fake domesticity makes me focus." That's not just a quirk. That's a genuine insight about how environment shapes cognition. The IKEA showroom is a third space. Not home, not office, but something in between that somehow works.
I think that's worth pausing on, because fake domesticity is doing a lot of work there. The showroom isn't just a random collection of furniture. It's a curated fantasy of domestic life that's cleaner, more organized, and more aesthetically coherent than anyone's actual home. There are no dishes in the sink. There's no mail piled on the counter. It's domesticity with all the friction removed. And for some people, that frictionless environment is conducive to focus.
It's like working in a movie set. Everything is placed with intention. There's no visual clutter that isn't design approved. Your brain isn't processing the mess of real life because there is no mess. The fake fruit in the bowl isn't a distraction. It's a signal that someone has already handled the grocery shopping.
IKEA's response to all of this has been, in its own way, kind of brilliant. They could have cracked down hard years ago. Posted signs, hired more security, made an example of a few nappers. They didn't. They tolerated, they adapted, they redesigned, they co-opted. They turned a liability into a cultural phenomenon and then started monetizing the phenomenon.
The testing zone pilot is the final stage of that co-optation. Once the nap pod exists, the unsanctioned nap becomes less appealing. Why risk the awkward staff interaction when there's a designated pod with a timer that won't get you in trouble? The rebellion gets domesticated.
I think there will always be people who push further. The nap pod has a 20-minute timer. Someone's gonna figure out how to reset it. Someone's gonna bring a sleeping bag to the testing zone. Someone's gonna try to check into an IKEA showroom on Airbnb. The boundary pushers don't stop when you give them a designated area. They just find the next boundary.
The AI monitoring will create a new frontier. People will figure out how to fool the computer vision. They'll learn the blind spots in the camera coverage. They'll develop techniques for appearing to be in motion while actually stationary. The arms race continues, it just moves to a different domain.
Which is why the enthusiast community matters. It's not just about getting away with something. It's about collectively mapping the limits of corporate tolerance and sharing that knowledge. It's a form of distributed consumer advocacy, even if it looks like people bragging about napping in a BJ-YAR-KS-NUS.
To answer the question directly, yes, people have pushed the boundaries, extensively, and they've reported back in extraordinary detail. You can work from a showroom desk for a full day if you pick the right store and the right weekday. You can nap in a bed for 20 minutes almost anywhere without intervention. You can push it to 45 minutes in more permissive locations. And if you want to know exactly which locations those are, the forums have you covered.
The unwritten rule, distilled from years of crowdsourced experimentation, is this. Act like you're evaluating a purchase, don't make a mess, and don't be so asleep that you drool. Everything else is negotiable.
If you're going to push it, document it. The community runs on data. Every nap report, every remote work session, every staff interaction is a data point that helps map the boundaries more precisely. You're not just testing a mattress. You're contributing to a years-long ethnographic study of Scandinavian corporate psychology.
Which is a very weird way to think about taking a nap in a furniture store. But here we are. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1913, a British geologist surveying in Somaliland discovered that certain local gypsum deposits fluoresced a vivid orange under ultraviolet light, an unintended consequence of trace manganese impurities that had leached into the mineral formation over millions of years. The geologist initially thought his lamp was malfunctioning.
Right. The IKEA showroom is a controlled experiment in human behavior, and the boundary pushers are unwitting test subjects. But the experiment is changing. The ambiguity that made it interesting is being replaced by timers and computer vision and designated zones. The question is whether something essential gets lost in that transition.
I think it does. The nap pod is useful, but it's not the same as falling asleep in a fake bedroom while strangers walk past and a child somewhere is having a meltdown about a Kallax unit. The chaos is part of it. The slight transgression is part of it. You can't package that.
You can try. And IKEA will try. They'll iterate on the testing zones. They'll refine the AI. They'll keep blurring the line between store and home right up until the lawyers tell them to stop. And the enthusiasts will keep finding the edges. That's the deal. That's the dance.
The nap is a small act of rebellion. And as long as there are showrooms, there will be people trying to sleep in them. The question isn't whether it'll keep happening. The question is whether anyone will still be looking the other way.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want more episodes like this one, find us at My Weird Prompts.
We'll be here, probably not napping.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.